with many recognitions dim and faint, and somewhat of a sad perplexity, the picture of the year revives again. Internationally, 1965 was the year of Vietnam. In Canada, it was the year of the flag raising, the Dorion Report, and the election that nobody wanted. The birth of 1965 was heralded by the trumpets of economic prosperity, and it was heralded by an historical free trade agreement between the United States and Canada. January 16th, 1965, a cold day in Ottawa, warm and windy in Texas, an agreement was being signed at the ranch of President Lyndon B. Johnson, an agreement that some observers saw as the first step towards complete economic union between the United States and Canada. The agreement was designed to achieve a substantial expansion in production and employment and to promote improved competitive efficiency in the Canadian automotive industry. External Affairs Minister Paul Martin made this statement following the signing.
The automotive agreement, which the Prime Minister and I have just signed, together with President Johnson and Secretary Rusk, is one of the most important commercial treaties ever made between the United States and Canada. It is the result of many months of careful preparation and close negotiation with our American friends. I am confident that it opens up exciting new prospects for the expansion of production and employment in the Canadian automotive industry. Our economy as a whole stands to gain, but I need hardly add that it is a source of rather special satisfaction for me that the benefits I confidently expect will be felt first and with the greatest impact in Windsor, my own city, and in other major centers of the industry.
At that exact moment in Ottawa, Industry Minister Drury was making a statement.
The main features of the program are a mutually beneficial arrangement between Canada, or between the Canadian and the United States governments, and assurances of increased production by producers of motor vehicles in Canada. The agreement with the United States makes provision for both Canada and the United States to remove tariffs and other customs barriers on motor vehicles and components for their manufacture. It should be borne in mind that replacement parts are not included in the program. Under the agreement, the United States will seek early congressional authority to enact duty-free treatment for the Canadian products and to make this treatment retroactive. For its part, Canada will allow eligible automobile manufacturers to import vehicles into Canada and their components on a duty-free basis.
When Prime Minister Pearson arrived back, he was met by newsmen, and he recalled the lighter moments that occurred during the agreement talks.
Our talks were conducted in a very novel fashion. As soon as I got to Texas on the ranch, and the airstrip is right on the ranch, even before I was allowed to put my hat in my room, I was put in a cart and taken from a cart to a golf cart to a helicopter, and from a helicopter to a large ranch where there were a lot of deer, and we had a motor cavalcade there, and we started right in for 2 hours and a half traveling around the Texas side. But during a lot of that time, we were talking business. He didn't get me on a horse. He confronted me when I arrived with a dog, the famous Beagle. And even that frightened me, if I had to ride it.
The plan would, among other things, achieve a substantial expansion in production and employment in the auto industry in Canada. Organized labor, as well as automobile and auto parts manufacturers, welcomed the plan as a bold and constructive measure in the national interest. John Diefenbaker has been called tenacious, determined, inflexible, and unyielding. But in the early months of 1965, he heard some new adjectives: pig-headed, obstinate, perverse, and blind. And even some of his own party went so far as to suggest he didn't realize when he was beaten, didn't know enough to give up. Conservatives were saying that John Diefenbaker could never again lead his party to victory, that the only one who didn't know it was John George Diefenbaker. But the old showman had some strong supporters in caucus, men of unswerving personal loyalty who had hitched their wagons to his star before and were prepared to do so again. Léon Balsé, the member for Trois-Rivières, wasn't one of them. He believed, to the extent of threatening to cross the floor of the House, that Mr. Diefenbaker was totally out of touch with Quebec, that he was blind to the French fact, and, in this belief, he had much support from Quebec and many English-speaking conservatives who felt the Diefenbaker leadership had run its course. The storm clouds gathered. A demand was heard repeatedly for a leadership convention. Finally, a meeting of the National Executive was called in Ottawa to discuss the possibility of a convention. But canny John Diefenbaker wasn't to be outmaneuvered. He called a caucus for the day before. Léon Balsé was asked if he would attend.
I feel that the problem that we are faced with are problems of leadership and national policies, and I think the National Executive is well equipped. It's sort of the proper body that is competent to deal with these problems, and I think calling a caucus, a party caucus for tomorrow, will not help matters and would just create embarrassment. And in my judgment, I feel that I better stay away from that caucus.
The old Tory warhorse received a resounding vote of confidence from the conservative members of the House, and when the executive met the next day, it was the opponents of the Diefenbaker leadership who found themselves outmaneuvered by the old campaigner.
As far as this meeting is concerned, this is an executive meeting. Leadership is determined at a national convention, and that leadership was determined in 1956 and is ratified subsequently on two or three occasions by national meetings. Conventions are only called when there's a vacancy, and I can tell you there's no vacancy as of this time.
John Diefenbaker won the round, but there were those in his own party who said that in saving his ego, he had lost an election. Their words were to re-echo on November the 8th. The flag debate of 1964 was one of the bitterest the House of Commons ever experienced and threatened to split Canada's parliament into two squabbling factions. But in 1965, the flag would fly, and indeed, February the 15th, it did fly. Governor General Georges Vanier saluted it.
As the red ensign is lowered, I salute it. And thank God for the blessings he bestowed upon it and us in the past. This is a time for rejoicing as well, because the flag of our country has been proclaimed by the Queen of Canada on the recommendation of the Canadian Parliament. And as it is raised, I salute it also and ask God to bless all those who will live and serve under it.
Prime Minister Pearson, with a heavy head cold and bundled against a brisk wind, made a speech that reflected the emotion of the moment.
If our nation, by God's grace, endure the 1,000 years, this day, the 15th day of February 1965, will always be remembered as a milestone in Canada's national progress. There are many in this country who regret the replacement of the red ensign by the red maple leaf, and their feelings and their emotions should be honored and respected. But I am sure that now that the decision had been made by the representatives of the Canadian people in Parliament assembled, that all Canadians and good patriots will accept that decision and will fly with pride and loyalty our national flag. The patriotic motive that have led Parliament to adopt a new Canadian flag do not include disrespect for our past or for the emblems of that past. Today we salute the future, but we honor the past on which the future rests under this flag. May our youth find new inspiration for loyalty to Canada, for a patriotism based on no mean or narrow purpose, but on the deep and equal pride that all Canadians will feel for every part of this good land. God bless Canada.
Then, as the Queen's proclamation was read, while a volley of shots rang out and the red ensign was coming down, the maple leaf flag went up and flew over Canada.
Now know ye that by and with the advice of our Privy Council for Canada, we do by this our royal proclamation appoint and declare as the national flag of Canada upon, from, and after the 15th day of February in the year of our Lord 1965.
A dapper little man named Lucien Rivard will be easily forgotten by history. His unsavory associates even now can be scarcely remembered. But Rivard was the small, hard man upon whom careers founded and scandals spawned. And his name was associated with the charge that organized crime had reached its slimy tentacles into the upper reaches of government. The United States wanted to extradite him on narcotics charges and was represented in its attempt by Montreal lawyer Pierre Lamontagne, who, it was stated, was offered a bribe. Opposition and public pressure became so intense that heads began to roll, and Prime Minister Pearson's Quebec lieutenant, who was also the Minister of Justice, was accused of having used poor judgment in not asking for or taking the advice of his own law officers. The Prime Minister himself became involved when there was some question over the date when Justice Minister Favreau told him that the affair seemed to reach into his own office. To clear the air, the government appointed Quebec Chief Justice Frédéric Dorion to investigate the affair, and in June, the Dorion report was released, which seemed to confirm that Mr. Favreau had been guilty of an error of judgment, and also that the Prime Minister had misled Parliament. Mr. Favreau resigned as Minister of Justice, a difficult step.
There's not much I care to say in the circumstances. You will understand that all I can say is that my colleagues, all caucus, Prime Minister leading them, see, have been just plain wonderful, see.
Eric Nielsen, Conservative member for the Yukon, who had broken the Rivard story, saw the resignation as inevitable.
My personal feeling is one of regret, but the portfolio of justice leaves no room for errors of judgment and leaves no room for conduct on the part of the holder of that portfolio, which will allow the Canadian people to have any doubt whatsoever in the security and the fairness in the administration of justice.
The Prime Minister was unhappy about the whole affair, but determined.
I don't think I need to emphasize my distress at losing Mr. Favreau as Minister of Justice. I agree with the decision that he has made. I don't think I need to emphasize also my gratitude to him for what he has done and to him for agreeing to remain in the government and serve his country. This has been a long, drawn-out, difficult, regrettable business. As soon as it became clear that something had to be investigated last November, we asked the Chief Justice of Quebec to investigate it. He has done that. He has made conclusions, and we will follow through on these conclusions, and we hope to clear up the difficulties, the dangers that have been exposed, and some were exposed, in the administration of justice in this country.
Days after the Dorion report had been released, a personal letter from Mr. Pearson resulted in the almost unprecedented event, a royal commissioner correcting his report after it had been completed, totally exonerating the Prime Minister. April 3rd, 1965, the third session of Canada's 26th Parliament prorogued on its 249th day of sitting after having experienced long, bitter debate, scandal, and the difficulties present in a parliament of minorities. April 5th, after a two-day respite, the third session of the 26th Parliament opened. The throne speech stressed that emphasis would be placed on the war on poverty. Prime Minister Pearson that day admitted some of the material in the speech from the throne was old, but he denied that any of it had been borrowed.
Well, some of it is old in the sense that we weren't able to get the program, all the proposals through in the last session that we had put on the order paper in the speech from the throne. That's quite true. We did a great deal last session, but we didn't complete our work. So far as the attack on poverty is concerned, President Johnson is doing that, but a lot of other Democratic governments are doing it. And we have been doing it in our own way in Canada for many years. But this is a new and enlarged and intensified attack on poverty.
Tommy Douglas, leader of the left-leaning New Democratic Party, thought the throne speech had some good points, but felt the Liberals were slow in moving towards socialistic ideals.
I wouldn't mind if they were really moving toward it. I have the easy feeling that they've borrowed the slogans without the programs. They've got the words without the actions. They've caught the words but not the music. They talk about economic planning, for instance. So they set up an economic council. And what do they do? The economic council has no power. And now they're going to set up a secretariat to wage war on poverty. But what power is it going to have? What authority is it going to have? What money is it going to have? This is what we want to know. It's all right to talk about waging war on poverty. You can't wage a war until, A, you've got some plans, B, you've got some troops, and C, you've got some weapons.
The leader of Her Majesty's loyal opposition, John Diefenbaker, said the mess in the government, along with legislation to clean it up, was all that was missing.
It doesn't indicate any repentance for what has been found in connection with the unmoral proclivities close to the government. And there's no determination on the part of the government, nothing of the kind that you would expect that would indicate that what messes exist are going to be cleaned up.
The year 1965 was a year of major accomplishments for the Liberal minority government of Lester Pearson. On July 8th, the Prime Minister called a press conference to announce that tenders would be called in the autumn of the year for the Prince Edward Island Causeway. The Causeway, an imaginative and exciting undertaking, would link the tiny East Coast provinces of New Brunswick and Prince Edward Island. A five-year, $148 million combined tunnel, bridge, and causeway project would begin in April of 1966. And the Prime Minister, in making the announcement, was pleased.
This announcement culminates, as most of you, I suppose, know, about 10 years of detailed study. And it will, when completed, fulfill the dream of the maritime provinces, a dream which will, I believe, even be before Confederation. It was always considered, I think, Mr. McNaught, down in the island, that this was one of the terms under which Prince Edward Island came into Confederation.
Never any doubt.
In 1873. This is not the first time that this government in 2 years has taken hold of problems that have been talked about for 75 years and have done something about them.
One of the happier events of the year occurred in Ottawa, July the 14th, and it swelled the hearts of Canadians everywhere who had come to love and respect Governor General Georges Vanier. It was rumored around Ottawa that the 77-year-old Queen's representative was considering retiring, and the problem was where to find a man who would command the respect and find a place in the hearts of Canadians as the Governor General had done. But the Prime Minister had an announcement to make that day, and he called in the press gallery to state the Governor General had agreed to remain in office for an indefinite period.
I can't really express adequately my feeling of appreciation and gratitude that he has been willing to do this. I think he and Madame Vanier have acted magnificently as the Queen's representative in Canada. We have been very fortunate to have had them in this position in the last 5 years, and it's good to know that they are going to continue to be at Rideau Hall.